5-6 million miles. Ooh.
This is Jim Hightower. Always tune in to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, community radio, supporting you and your community.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Millicent E. Brown, Dr. Millicent E. Brown, joining us via phone from South Carolina, and we'll be talking about her book, Another Sojourner Looking for Truth, My Journey from Civil Rights to Black Power and Beyond. Millicent, thank you so much for joining us via phone today.
I'm delighted to be with you. I really am.
And are you in Charleston today? Is that
I am in Charleston. Yes. Yes.
And I love
I have returned home. This is where it all began, and now after many years I have come back to the scene of the crime.
Yes, and you never really expected that you might be returning home. It seems like from the places that you've traveled, the experiences, but we'll get to hear a little bit about that, because this is what Another Sojourner Looking for Truth. This is your story of a time so important in our nation's story. Before we get too far away from it, thank you for picking today's songs. And why did you pick the Sonny Rollins to lead with, Millicent?
I picked it, and it's interesting that because there are no words, that might seem like a strange choice for, you know, leading into our discussion. But I wanted to really take the opportunity to make a point that often is not made when people are talking about what we call the civil rights movement, black power struggle, and what have you. And that is to say to people, please don't pigeonhole the struggles of the mid-20th century into just legalistic and political science cubbyholes. I picked Sonny Rollins, as I could have picked many other, Max Roach, and many other musicians, Abby Lincoln, because I really want to drive home the point that this struggle, a long, ongoing struggle, crossed over into cultural realms as well. That musicians and artists and painters of all and all different kinds of creatives were involved in some way with advancing what we now commonly refer to as civil rights. And it's not just the court challenges and or the demonstrations in the streets. And I just wanted to just have a chance to start our conversation with that realization that this struggle has been in the hearts and minds of people contributing in many different ways.
In any way that they have the gift to contribute.
Absolutely, absolutely. I spend a lot of time, not just in the book, but in the other consulting that I do, in the public speaking that I do, in the reflecting about my own experiences over many decades. I'm always trying to remind people that while we honor and give respect for the people that we know about, the Martin Luther Kings of the world, we really have to constantly be reminded how ordinary people were advancing this movement, and that it's almost dangerous for us. It's neglectful, but it's almost dangerous for us to concentrate only on those names, whether it's Rosa Parks or King or even Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. I mean, there are so many names that we now associate with the struggle, and we forget about all the unknown people.
Yes, and in something, and we can't, and we have to fight against that. And I love how when you sent this song, you also wrote, Millicent, you wrote, this album represents freedom against racism as well as any ever has.
Absolutely. And again, you know, Freedom Suite, understanding the time in which it was written, I believe it was 1960, but the idea that we're talking about a point in American history for sure, but it isn't a new struggle. And the musicians and the artists, as I mentioned earlier, are all chiming in, and they're saying that we're going to bring in melodies and rhythms, whether it's from the motherland, the continent of Africa, whether it's from the Caribbean, whether it's the jazz expression, whether it's bebop, you know, it's everybody's understanding that we're trying to connect dots here, that legal freedoms, political freedoms, social advancement is tied intimately to the culture of people over many, many, many centuries.
And recognizing that, like you're saying, yes. Well, it's especially, I think it's really wonderful that this is the point where you wanted to start our conversation, especially considering the part that your family has also played in some of the legal aspects like in the court, like taking the Charleston School Board District Number 20 to court, and your father being the local leader of the NAACP, and then the statewide leader going on to mm-hmm. be. And so knowing that that's one way in the book, Millicent, it seems like you start the story where it feels like this is what you're born into. This is what you were living and breathing every day of your life in Charleston with activism
yeah,
of
yeah,
your
yeah.
Your parents.
I think that is probably why the book actually got written. I, for so long, did not see my family or even my own contributions as being as unique as they were.
Really?
And
really?
Yeah. I think, and I don't mean to sound like it's a false modesty. It's just that I never wanted to think that my contributions or our contributions were any greater than so many other people's. And then I got old. I mean, literally, I just got old. And then I realized, wait a minute. You have been through, you have experienced some things that, quote unquote, an average household perhaps has not experienced. And so there's sort of an obligation to unpack that, you know, and let's just forget the modesty part, you know, and let's just help people understand in today's time, help people to understand what it's like to be born into an activist household. Yes. I take great pride looking back on the activities of my father and his peers, his colleagues, and just realizing that we all have to pay attention to the time into which we are born. I don't think that there's some mysterious, mystical reason why our family did what we did. It had a lot to do with when, you know, what was going on, what had been going on. But as more and more attention was being paid to the changes being brought about by mid-20th century, I realized, oh my gosh, you know, not everybody's father is the kind of leader that mine was. I not everybody was surrounded intimately with national characters, if you will, that were taking leadership positions around the nation. And not everybody had Judge Constance Baker Motley or Roy Wilkins or Thurgood Marshall staying in our home, or Marguerite Belafonte, you know, staying in our home. And after a while, I realized, no, I really do want to try to share what that looks like from a young person's perspective, because I started paying attention. I'm 8 years old. I'm 10 years old. Mm. And this is just normal for our household.
You're driving to Tennessee with your dad and sisters to go to a folk school, you know, during those years, for example, too. Like, these are the things you would just do every summer.
Yes, and I don't know how many in your listening audience are aware or familiar with Highlander Folk School, but it is an incredible operation that exists to this day. It was founded in 1932, and it was a major location for labor organizing. And over time, from the 30s into the 40s and well into the 50s, it became a location, Mount Eagle, Tennessee, right outside of Chattanooga. It became a partner with the then emerging civil rights struggle. And it became a place that, one of the very rare places in the South, for sure, where whites and blacks actually got together on an equal footing and lived together, sang together, ate together, slept together. And I say slept, I didn't mean in a sexual way. I mean in the cabins, you know, we were bunk mates. That's what I meant to say. But I'm growing up, and my siblings and I are going to Highlander, and I'm surrounded by writers like Harry Golden, and I meet Eleanor Roosevelt.
That's amazing.
You know, and it's like there are people who are working together to advance what these causes of human rights really are all about. And so you can imagine as a child, you know, that some of this is going way over my head.
But also,
and I don't understand.
But oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't understand all of the adult conversations, but who have had that experience as a child of the South, who had never seen blacks and whites operating on an equal basis before. And so it was something that I saw in my youth, and that began my appreciation that what I was living through down in Charleston in South Carolina, that was staunchly segregated, that something's not right there. You know, that's not the way people really interact with one another. And it is possible to operate in a different way than what I was seeing in my hometown all the time.
Millicent, let's take a short break and then we'll come back and we'll hear more. We're going to bring it back to your hometown. We're going to go back to Charleston on the other side of the break. Today on Living Writers, Millicent E. Brown joins us via phone from Charleston, South Carolina. Another sojourner looking for truth. My journey from civil rights to black power and beyond, out with the University of South Carolina Press. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. And I mean every word of it. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, Dr. Millicent E. Brown joins us via phone. Her book, On the Table, Another Sojourner Looking for Truth, My Journey from Civil Rights to Black Power and Beyond. Millicent, thanks for picking some Nina Simone for today, too. Were you able to hear the song?
Okay. I did, yeah.
Good, Jason's got it hooked up, so it's traveling across the airwaves to all of us.
And let me just say that as a child of South Carolina, I need to just share with you that for so long, when people talk about civil rights activism and some of the horrors of the segregated South, depending on where you're from, you kind of throw a blanket over it and you see the Southland as being the same. Those of us who are from the various states know that there were different brands of discrimination, depending on where you lived and how it was meted out. And so in South Carolina, and I think it has a lot to do with the aristocratic nature of this state from the very beginning of the founding of this nation, but South Carolina prided itself in not having stooped to being a Mississippi or an Alabama. And so our brand of discrimination and segregation had some complexities to it. It is not to suggest that we didn't have horrors like a lot of the other areas, but there were leaders here that did not want to be seen as a Mississippi or an Alabama. They said that we carried ourselves better than that. So our brand of discrimination might have been less, maybe less obvious. Our Klan didn't always ride through the streets the way they may have in Alabama or Mississippi. And that's one of the struggles that I go through in my memoir, is trying to sort out this heinous thing of white supremacy, but it showed itself differently depending on where you lived.
Yes. And even, Millicent, in the very early pages of your book, I know you're speaking between states, and that was what you were just speaking about, but even describing the layout of Charleston and the side of town where you lived and the reasons why, like the west side of the peninsula versus the east side of it, the areas of like who settled where, and what were the jobs of the folks that lived in each of the different areas. Your book is a record of witness for so many parts of this country's story that we're not all facing up to, or even somehow being asked to. And if you don't think about the history, like you said, like for you, you live all of it. And so there's not a way that you can be like, I'm living history right now. You know, like that, like you said earlier, like you're a child. This is what you know as what it is. This is who's at the kitchen table tonight, or this is who's, you know, having a smoke out on the porch, or whatever it is. But then once you reach a certain point, you do have this understanding, like, this is my time and this is my role in this time. And maybe we could look towards this, because you were thrust into a role for the movement, for the struggle, because your sister, Minerva, she aged out of the suit against Charleston School Board that your father had filed. And
yes, let me explain that a little bit. Another correction that I try to give to audiences is the fact that a lot of people are taught or would assume that once the Supreme Court case of 1954, Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, Board of Ed, you know, was decided, that, okay, then the schools desegregated. And it was so important that people understood that a number of states, South Carolina being one of them, said, we don't care what the Supreme Court says. You know, we are not going to desegregate. And so in 54, that decision is made, and my parents, and I don't want to make it be just my father, because it truly was both my parents, put my sister forward to be one of the first students to desegregate the schools. But a ploy that was used in many southern states was to just prolong. And when they tried to transfer my sister, we were denied that, and it forced the case in South Carolina, in Charleston particularly. We had to go into the courts, you know, and you would think, but there's already a Supreme Court decision. Why do you have to still go into the courts? And so people don't understand that not only was that time and aggravation, and in many cases intimidation against people who were willing to do it, it was also costly, because the NAACP locally had to raise money to pay for lawyers. And so Minerva's case goes on and on, and she becomes a senior. and is about to graduate, and then that became the latest ploy. No, you would then be not eligible to transfer because you're going to have graduated. And that was a game that was played in many states, that we consider that your case, your challenge to be moot. And my father took great pleasure in referring to me as his ace up his sleeve. He had another daughter. And so he went down to the courthouse, and we got Minerva's name removed from that case and replaced it with my name. And that case stayed in my name for 3 more years, so that in 1963, 10 other students and I became the first students to desegregate South Carolina public schools. This is 9 years after Brown versus Board of Ed, Topeka.
And
it's really important just to make people again understand not just the legalities, but for us to ask some deeper questions about resistance. You know, change does not come easily. And even if a Supreme Court decision or a court case is decided, it doesn't mean that local officials and politicians and communities are going to comply. And our case was, in fact, an example of that. And as it turned out, multiple plaintiffs that had started with my sister, they had either changed their minds, they had moved away, they had graduated. So when you see the Millicent Brown et al. Case, that actually is successful in 1963, it's a whole different set of students, you know. And so things have had to just change along the way. And I try to bring that out in the memoir so that we just kind of remember to ask some different kinds of questions when we assume that our government or our country is doing the right thing. We really do have to look at what resistance to change really looked like.
Yes. And it feels so interesting to hear you say that in this moment, when we can see what a resistance to change looks like when it seems to take a country backwards, or returning to another administration that had already been in the past, for example, and then what's required to fight going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, in terms of why I really wanted to document my life's journey of being involved from childhood literally until today, is to just caution people that change is not always permanent. And I am a woman in her 70s who thought that we'd already done this work, that this was already behind us. We started it well before my lifetime, but we especially got geared up in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, whether it was with voting rights, whether it was with civil rights and public accommodations, whether it was with school desegregation. I mean, it was like, okay, this is behind us. And so we are certainly living in a time that has to be a reminder about the importance of defending rights and not assuming that because something has changed that it is permanent.
So true. So true, Millicent. Let's take a really short break, and then we'll come back, and I'd like to pick up with 1963 too. Today on Living Writers, Dr. Millicent E. Brown joins us via phone from South Carolina, another sojourner looking for truth, my journey from civil rights to black power and beyond, out with the University of South Carolina Press. And my great thanks to Kathy Esposito for sending along the book. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
I'm gonna sit at the welcome table, oh Lordy. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table. I'm gonna sit at the welcome table one of these days, one of these days. I'm gonna be a registered voter, oh Lord. I'm gonna be a registered voter one of these days, hallelujah. I'm gonna be a registered voter. I'm gonna be a registered voter one of these days.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time, because today Dr. Millicent E. Brown is here via phone to talk about her memoir, Another Sojourner Looking for Truth, My Journey from Civil Rights to Black Power and Beyond. Millicent, thank you for choosing this song too. listening to it, why did you put this one in? This goes along with chapter 5 in the memoir.
I wanted us to be reminded of what that belief was in the black community, and not just in the South but throughout the country. This idea that once we get recognized for our as real citizens, you know, once we actually have access to the voting booth there, that's where freedom was going to come from. And at my age now, it seems a little bit naive, but I really remember that's what people felt, you know, that no matter how hard things had been, once laws changed and once people could vote, then people would take us seriously, take our communities seriously. Then this country was going to move on and embrace everybody. Didn't necessarily work that way. when I and the others were involved in school desegregation, we didn't know that white parents were going to immediately do the white flight thing and leave the public school system and start creating private schools, you know, still running away from the reality that we are a mixture.
Yes. And the reality that a public school is for all of us. Millicent, are you there? Did I can't hear Jason. Is Millicent still there? Hello? Hello? Folks, what's going out over the air right now, Jason? Is it? I'll keep talking, or is it? Sorry, folks. It seems like we might have an issue with the connection at the moment. I thought it was just my headphones, and I didn't want to speak over Millicent, but now I'm not sure if we've got a dropped call on our hands. but Jason's working to see if we can get Millicent back on the line. And we'll, let's see. Give us just a moment. And while we figure this out, we've got "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised."
You will not be able to stay home, brother.
You know.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
On the line? Hello, Millicent? Do we have you back on the line? Hello? Millicent, I'm gonna keep saying hello. Do we have you on the line? Whoop. Okay, we might be switching over to another line, folks. Not to worry. This is what makes Living Writers also freeform, right? We're gonna see what happens. and it's so nice that we whoop, we've got another song.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel got to go round. Talking about your troubles, it's a crying sin. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money and you got no home. Spinning wheel all over.
Hello, Millicent. We've got you back on the line. It's so good. It's so good to hear your lovely voice.
Well, I don't know how long I was talking to myself.
You know, that there might have been a moment, because I definitely thought you were still talking. And so I was waiting. And then I was like, maybe Millicent is pausing for me to say something. And that's when I realized. But But could we, would you mind, could we pick up with, could I ask you about what the first day was like and what it was like to write about the first day at Rivers High School on September 4th, 1963? Because you said it had, again, taken years with your name as the lead on this. And what was it like to write the story? Because is this a story that you would share with family and friends? Would you talk about this? Was this something that was harder to write than you thought or easier to write? Could you tell us the story and what it was like for you with the memoir?
Yeah. Let me just say that for many years now, because of my having been the chief plaintiff in the case that not only desegregated schools in Charleston, we were the first for the state of South Carolina. So ever since I was 15 years old, I have been asked to talk about that first day. You know, what was it like the first year, you know? So I have had years and years of going over those experiences. And let me just say that they were filled with mixed emotions. My picture appeared on the front page of the New York Times, and it's a picture I hate because I'm smiling, talking to a woman who would end up being probably my first and only real friend at the school. But so it wasn't that interaction that was bad, but it did not in any way reflect what was going on in my stomach at the time. I was filled with one anxiety after another. And that had to do with the fact that when we were taken into the school, I immediately was taken to my homeroom class, which was right opposite the front door of the school. And I panicked. Because my thought was, what do they know that I don't know that they think I have to be that close to the exit? You know, what's about to happen that I need to get out of this door so quickly? You know, my imagination was running wild. My next bit of anxiety was my homeroom teacher was, I'm tall, and I've been tall since I was 14 years old. I'm about 5'7" at the time. My homeroom teacher is about 4'6", a very tiny little woman, and I get taken to her, and she's standing outside the classroom, and she is just apoplectic. I mean, she's so nervous and as if she's saying, why me? Why me? Why does it have to be my class? You know? And I immediately go into a guilt thing. I'm afraid that this woman is going to have a heart attack because of my presence.
And why would you have to be worried about that? I mean, she couldn't protect you if you needed protecting.
Well, it took years for me to work through the anxiety. But, I mean, it even goes to the fact that I just, even when we had bomb threats that first day, you know, and there were like 3 bomb threats, you know, and people were turning and getting angry at me as if I had done something wrong. And, you know, you're 15 years old and you just take it all in. And I remember the first days, weeks, even the whole 3 years that I was at that school, just weighing on my shoulders was guilt. You know, I've disrupted this school. You know, I've caused this anxiety with my teacher, whatever. And it took me a while to be able to sort that through and put the grievance where it really belonged, not even on the individual students or even the ones that were ugly to me. After a while, over years, I realized that's what white supremacy is.
Yes.
That's what white supremacy is. That's the ugliness that we have people feeling responsible for things they didn't even create.
Yes.
And so it helped me as I left high school, as I went to college, I left the South, I went North, you know, as I went on with my life involved in social activism, but trying to sort through what are the lessons that we are not clearing up. You know, who are we blaming for things that are, it's not their fault. It is systemic racism and discrimination that is responsible, but we're blaming the players. And it just took me years to sort that through. And it started, I was so anxious, actually. My first few years, I spent 3 years at that school. And I was always trying to be the ideal black student. You know, I just had to represent the whole race. Mm-hmm. And it's a very unfair burden, but in my later years as a college professor and as a researcher, I've spent a lot of time trying to explain to people the phenomenon of school desegregation in this country needs to be looked at not only as a political or a legal challenge, but we need to get a recognition that these are children all over the country,
yes,
being asked to be change agents. And I don't feel even today we have enough of an appreciation that on the backs of children, we haven't asked about their emotional and psychological well-being. And so I make a big point of saying, I don't want just the history majors and the political science majors to study the phenomenon of school desegregation. I want the psychologists, the sociologists, the anthropologists, the educators to just really take some time to reflect on what it's like to be ostracized. You know, we hear about bullying, not only because of race or sexual orientation or national origin, you know, but what does it mean for a child to be marginalized? And so I carry that sensitivity based on my own experiences, but I spread it out to all kinds of circumstances, even today. Let's be careful what we're asking children to suffer through without recognizing their humanity and their vulnerability.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, Millicent, because it's...
I have written this book to try to say to readers, and it is going to be coming out as an audio book by next month, I understand, that I want readers and listeners to understand that there's a backstory and that we owe it to each other to just remember that, yeah, there were these folks that did these phenomenal, so-called brave, courageous things. But what were they really thinking? And are we understanding some of the resistance to change and the ploys that people are taking? The putting the blame on the wrong people, you know, all of these circumstances just kind of challenge us to do some deeper thinking,
yes,
some deeper thinking. And that's really what the book was aimed at. I wanted people to understand, you know, you think you know something about the civil rights movement. Well, think about it through the eyes of the children.
Yes.
You know, you think you understand the Black Power movement. You know, what is this importance of, no, we went from being Negroes to being Black? You know, what's that all about? You know, what was this need for the artists and the musicians to join in with the demonstrators and the politicians and say, you know, this is a cultural transformation that is trying to attempt to combat this awful thing called white supremacy, where people think that one group of people is superior to another. It's nonsense, but we have to unpack it. And that's why I tell people I started off in being born in the middle of the 20th century. I was colored, then I became Negro, then I became Afro-American, and then it's African-American. You know, it's like each one of those was a stage of consciousness building.
Yes.
Until I get to where I am today, and I'm beginning to understand, oh my gosh, we have to tell people it's okay to keep growing. You know, keep stretching your imagination.
Yes.
And understanding more clearly.
Yes, because you are you, and what we're talking about are ways of trying to understand, or categories or labels, or, but in the best possible sense, ways of growing, like you said, like ways of understanding and becoming. But you're the person, you're still you, Millicent, even though you're saying to from an outside perspective or a sociological lens or whatever it is, you could have been all these other things through those times, right?
Well, let me just also say that one of the things about the book, while a lot of it talks about the earlier years for sure, I end the book really talking about the 21st century. I talk about Charleston today.
Yes.
You know, I talk about have we made changes? Of course we've made changes. But is that progress? Are we fooling ourselves? You know, why is it that I don't care whether you're in South Carolina or any other state in the entire nation, why do we know predictably who will be at the bottom of the economic and social ladder? And so that raises a question about how much real institutional change has happened. Because if I can go to Spokane, Washington, you know, and I know who's going to be the working class. I know whose education level is going to be the least. I know whose housing is going to be the worst. I know whose health is going to be the most challenged.
If that's not a system, then if that's not systemic.
And that's how we begin to explore. And that's why I said about these deeper questions. We've got to figure out that this doesn't have anything to do with, well, I put it this way. Either you believe that there's something wrong with those black and brown folks because they can't get their act together. You either believe that, or you come to the realization that there is something systemic going on that would identify certain people to be at certain rungs of society. And I tell people, you get to choose, but I think that our scientists would tell us that going for a biological or genetic kind of deficiency would probably not get you very far.
Yeah. That's the limited small-minded perspective to cling to.
Yeah, it really does mean that we can all be challenged to just look at what are the systems that surround us, and if we're going to have corrections to them, we have to be able to confront the truth. You know, we really do have to look at what real history is, what has really happened in this nation, not what we've been taught, unfortunately, through some very narrow lens.
Yes.
And, I'm still a positive person to an extent. I only get to feeling a little down when I think we're resisting the truth. That's the only thing that saddens me. I think as long as people are willing to really explore and try to find out what really happened as opposed to what we were taught.
Yes.
You
yes.
know, I think we can possibly succeed as a society.
We have some hope. And that's why it's in your title, Looking for Truth. And what you say in your memoir many times, Millicent, you come back to this is the truth. This is the truth that I know that I will write.
Yeah.
And what compelled you to stay with us and write this book.
And to encourage others encourage others, because it's not like I have these answers. You know, I want people to feel their own sense of empowerment. Don't wait on the next Dr. Martin Luther King to come, you know, or whoever it is someone may have as their hero or heroine. You know, we've got to begin to understand the importance of whatever our circle is. It might be a book club. It might be a class. It might be a sewing club. It might be a yoga class. I mean, it doesn't matter what the group is. Wherever you sit, are you willing to be a spokesperson for justice and for the rights of all people? You know, and we cannot leave that up to the brave ones and the ones that we lift up as idols. You know, I'm not into idolatry, and I respect people who have sacrificed, definitely. But I caution all of us, don't keep elevating one person or two people or three people. We really do have to look to our left, look to our right, and then look in the mirror. And we have to say, you know, I may not lead a movement like someone, but when I sat at that board meeting or at that PTA meeting or when I was in that student council table, I spoke up for the best that could be given to the largest number of people. And I just think that that's the foundation that we really have an opportunity to take from the civil rights movement of long ago. But we really can bring that into today's time now. Did I speak truth about how to best help the largest number of people? That, to me, that's the guiding principle that I think all of us can claim.
Thank you. Thank you, Millicent. Thank you for your journey, your life's work that continues. that we are all a witness here on this moment with you. Thank you for writing the book, Another Sojourner, Looking for Truth, My Journey from Civil Rights to Black Power and Beyond. And thanks ever so much for talking today via phone. Dr. Millicent E. Brown. Thank you, Millicent.
I appreciate it so very much, and I thank you for the work that you do, too.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thanks to all of you out there for listening. Thanks to folks for being part of our fundraiser last week. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks to Mom for listening. You've got sports up next, folks. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution, sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines. rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run.
Hello, you are listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It is 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, the 26th, which means it is time for the Daily Sports Report. I am joined by Charlie and Andrew. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing pretty good, and Charlie is right now closing the door.
We're live, just let you know, Charlie. So
yeah, okay. So today we have an interesting topic that I've been wanting to think about. You know, in the past month, you know, we've had past month, 2 months, we've had the NFL Pro Bowl, we've had the NBA All-Star Game, and then we've had the NHL Four Nations Face-Off. You know, it's got me thinking, like, what do you guys think is the best and worst All-Star Game in the major four sports in the U.S.? Like, if you guys had the choice to watch, like, if you guys had to rank them, had the choice to watch them, which one would you rank first, which one would you rank last?
Well, let's start at the low end, and I think right now both the NFL and the NBA are in absolute rut with their All-Star games. The Pro Bowl, of course, a couple of years ago, went over the flag football, and while the players seem to enjoy it, it is not the best fan experience. I mean, the players seem to have fun, just doesn't translate over very well to me, at least, as a football fan. I think it's kind of a poor excuse for the usage of an All-Star game. I mean, the last Pro Bowl, I believe, that had full contact football was the one in Las Vegas. That the only thing I remember from that was Mac Jones falling over himself on a breakaway run. But even when the last couple of years, when they were retooling the Pro Bowl, it just felt kind of, it felt bland. They tried changing the styles. Okay, they went to AFC, NFC,